Morning. The core question in this case is exactly the kind of question that this court addressed in Morris, which is whether the whether what the statute here calls a government-controlled instrumentality, which is the Puerto Rico Ports Authority, is an arm of the state for sovereign immunity purposes. Yet when the Commission developed its analytical framework for addressing these kinds of issues in the Ceres Terminal case, the Commission didn't even bother to discuss or analyze Morris, even though it recognized in footnote 4 of that decision that all of its decisions on sovereign immunity issues can be appealed to this circuit. And not surprisingly,
it can be appealed to other circuits as well, right?
That's true. That's true. And its lawyers' attempt to defend the application of the Ceres Terminal framework in this case likewise never really comes to grips with Morris. And so today I'd like to do two things. I'd like to first explain why we think that Morris compels a finding that the authority here is in fact an arm of the Commonwealth, and second, why neither of the Commission's apparent reasons for declining to apply Morris holds water. Now, as the Court's aware, Morris looked at three factors, the intent of the sovereign, the amount of control it exercises, and the risk to the Treasury. And under those factors, the authority is, if anything, more clearly entitled to sovereign immunity than the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, or WMATA, that was at issue in Morris. First, the indicators of intent to confer immunity are at least as strong here as in Morris. Here is there, the Commonwealth has not designated the authority as a political subdivision, but has instead designated it by statute as a government-controlled instrumentality. Here, as in Morris, the Commonwealth has filed an amicus brief, clearly stating its intention to confer immunity. And the Commonwealth has given the authority here even greater responsibility for a bigger part of its economic infrastructure than Maryland and Virginia gave to WMATA in Morris. The FMC's amicus brief
has a perverse incentive in some respects, because by saying Puerto Rico would be responsible, it ensures that Puerto Rico would not be responsible.
Well, that's true. That's true. But
so I'm not sure how much that gets you logically in the end. But
well, that was one of the things that this court relied upon in Morris as
I'm
an indicator of
about
intent.
The logic of it.
Of intent. Sure. The FMC in their briefing never really dispute the intent element. Their main argument is to cite the Trans-Caribbean decision from an intermediate Puerto Rico appellate court, which didn't even address the question of sovereign immunity. It addressed whether there had been a waiver of sovereign immunity. Second, the Commonwealth here exercises at least as much control as the states exercised over WMATA in Morris. The enabling statute, as I noted, clearly says that the authority is government-controlled. And as in Morris, that control is reflected in the Commonwealth's ability through the governor to effectively control four of the five votes on the authority's
board. Suppose they weren't removable at will. Would that change your position?
That would make it a harder case, certainly. I think given the other factors
here.
That's
a key factor here, then, you're saying.
I think it's an important factor, but in Morris, that's a reason why we have a stronger case than Morris. In Morris, they were not removable at will, but here they are.
There's no formal veto power here. It's the removable at will that gets you the power.
Right, right. And as in Morris, the Commonwealth obviously retains the power to override rules that are promulgated by the authority or decisions that they make. And beyond that,
I'm sorry, isn't that always going to be true? I mean, the state,
I think the Commonwealth has
legislative power. Right?
I think that's true. That was one of the things the court relied upon in Morris, though. But here, there's even more. Here, Commonwealth law precisely defines and delimits the authority's rulemaking power. It specifies standards for its administrative procedures and its personnel decisions and its procurement practices, and it requires periodic reports to the legislature. Now, the FMC, both in its decision and in its briefs, cite a few facts that suggest that the Commonwealth's control is somewhat less than complete. They cite things like the power to sue and be sued, the power to set rates, the power to issue bonds and borrow money, and those sorts of things. It's true that those things indicate that the Commonwealth's control is less than complete, but all of those things were also present in Morris. And Morris held the standard is not complete control, but significant control.
You seem to be holding off the big distinction between Morris and this.
That's my next point, Your Honor. And, and on the risk to the Treasury point, on balance, we think the authority poses as much risk to the Commonwealth here as WMATA did.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, if the authority defaults on bonds on Addendum 20, then a receiver takes over?
I think that's right.
And
that's a powerful reason why the Commonwealth, as a practical matter, would need to step in and prevent that from happening.
Well, then why is that provision even in there? I mean, I was trying to figure out how this would actually work. A receiver comes in and takes over this authority. It would be very odd.
And it would seem to allow for a situation or an entity rather like any bankruptcy that you've got a receiver who's running and winding down and settling. And that doesn't sound like a government arm, does it?
Well, certainly if a receiver actually came in and did that, I'm not sure exactly what the situation with respect to bankruptcy in Morris was. I imagine that if WMATA were to go bankrupt, that there would be a similar mechanism that would take
Unless
over there.
Unless you know what it says in there. I don't see how you can assume that that is the case.
Yeah, I don't know what the situation is there. But again, that's a powerful practical reason why the Commonwealth would want to step in, because obviously that would be contrary to the Commonwealth's interest to allow the authority to be taken.
That's the reason it might want to step in, but that doesn't mean it would be required to. That's not the public fisc at risk there, unless the public makes a later decision to put its fisc at risk.
Well, Your Honor, I think that was exactly the situation in Morris. There was no legal requirement that Maryland and Virginia step in. The court
The practice was such that it was plain that WMATA was dependent upon incessant infusions of government money.
Was and is.
Yeah,
that's true.
Is, right.
There was that practice, and I agree with you that's not
that
present
to be
here.
That's what the court rested on.
Well, that was one of the things the court rested on. The court also said that as a practical matter, Maryland and Virginia would be required, would have a strong incentive to step in if there were a substantial shortfall. So you're right. We don't have that in our case, but we have a couple of other things that were not present in Morris. One is the fact that in Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rico Ports Authority has a far greater economic significance to the economy of Puerto Rico than WMATA does to the economy of either Maryland or Virginia.
You make the point that its writ runs over, I guess, the navigable waters of Puerto Rico.
And the airports. You can't get in or out without going.
But my understanding is Ponce is different, is excluded. Is that correct?
There are a couple of. I think there's one airport that's excluded, and maybe one port that's excluded.
As a practical matter, are we talking about much more than San Juan?
No, I think you're talking about. I'm not sure how many other ports there are, but I can find out and answer that on rebuttal if you would like. But it's all of the navigable waters in and around Puerto Rico with very limited exceptions.
But it's a port's authority, so where there's just beachfront, it's probably not very active.
That's probably right. But it does also control the airports, which is obviously very significant. So the authority has greater economic significance. In addition to that, there's another factor that was not present in Morris, and that is that at least in some circumstances, a lawsuit against the authority is actually answerable at law by the Commonwealth itself under Section 2303B.
There's no contention this is such a lawsuit. Is that right? Is there?
I believe there has been a contention that it might be.
Yeah, it's debated, right?
It is debated. We don't think there. Our position is there would not be a claim, but at least in some circumstances, whether or not that provision would actually apply to this dispute, unlike the WMATA situation.
Your argument has to do with the structure.
I'm sorry?
Your argument is that the existence of that provision bears on our analysis of the structure of the authority.
And also, ultimately, the risk that this agency poses to the Commonwealth's FISC. Let me just quickly discuss the two reasons that I understand the FMC has given for not following Morris here. First, they say that they can't be bound by decisions that predate the Supreme Court's decision in FMC versus South Carolina Ports. But South Carolina Ports cast no doubt on the Morris framework, which implicitly protects the state's dignity interests at every turn.
I'm going back a second, so I apologize. But
okay.
On 2303, how often has that arisen, do you know, where the Commonwealth's been put into a case because of a suit against the authority?
I don't know how often it has arisen. I can try to find out.
Okay.
Anyway, the FMC tries to avoid Morris by saying, well, it came before South Carolina Ports. At most, the South Carolina Ports decision suggests that the Morris factor should be supplemented by an express focus on dignity. Second, the FMC has said that it can't be bound by a single circuit's law because more than one circuit, as we discussed earlier, in this case the First Circuit, may ultimately have jurisdiction over a challenge to the FMC's decision. Now, although we disagree with certain aspects of the First Circuit's approach to these issues, for reasons we discussed at some length in our briefs, we think we would win if we were before the
Circuit. I realize I should be directing this to your opposing counsel, but you're the one that's up here right now.
Okay.
It can't really be seriously contended that we don't have to go by our own precedent, can it?
Well, I think that's right.
I mean, this is not like an Erie Doctrine question where we'd be applying the law of the place.
That's exactly right.
Reason to apply state law, we have to apply this circuit's law.
That's exactly right. And the fact that the FMC may find itself in something of a dilemma as to which circuit's law to apply, I think, is easily dealt with when you look at an executive order that is not binding in court but directs the agency as to what it should do. Executive Order 13132 tells the agency if there are two different approaches to dealing with an issue that bears on federalism, you choose the approach that is most respectful of and protective of states' interests. And they could have done that here. They could have followed this court's approach in Morris, and they didn't. And so unless they're going to ask the court to reverse Morris, we don't see
that
we're
going to do that.
That's right.
Can I ask you a couple factual
sure.
questions about how this works? When the four officers are working on authority business, as opposed to their usual official duties, do they get separately paid for that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I doubt it, but I don't know.
And does anyone profit from the authority's revenues if it has more revenues than outlays in a particular year, other than the Commonwealth gets the up to, I guess it's $400,000 back?
No, it's a break-even business, and in fact, the Commonwealth
is rolled back into authority projects, I assume.
That's right, and the authority hasn't even been able to remit that $400,000 to the Commonwealth in years and years. Thank you.
They've never tested that proposition on the ground.
Right.
Hear from the respondent.
May it please the Court. My name is Corey Sinkew. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Maritime Commission. Judge Santel, just to get back to your question, the Commission is not asking this Court to abandon its test in Morris. We are, however, submitting that the Morris test and the Commission's test are consistent.
Yeah, what you're going to have to show us is that you're in compliance with Morris. Is that not correct? I mean, without regard to the abstract proposition of whether the two tests are compatible, you have to show that in this case you would win under the Morrison test.
We do submit that we would win under the Morris test. Indeed, we do feel that both tests are very similar. They both examine the relationship between the state and the entity, including the manifest intent of the state in creating the entity, how the entity operates, and whether the state has chosen to support its entity with its own treasury. So while the two tests may be phrased slightly differently, they are substantially
similar. Can a state create a self-sufficient state entity?
I'm sorry?
Can a state create a self-sufficient state entity that's still an arm of the state?
Indeed, I believe that was the result in Morris, where WMATA was found to be self-sufficient.
Wasn't that the result here, then?
No, PRIPA is not self-sufficient. PRIPA is self-sufficient.
Right.
They do not receive funding from the state. Indeed, they make annual contributions into the state's treasury.
I meant self-sufficient at the back end in terms of covering debts, but in other words, the state's not going to back up the debts of the entity it's created.
Correct.
But it's going to control the activities of the entity.
Well, there's
assume, no. I guess another way of phrasing it, assume 100% state control of the entity, but assume that the state's not going to cover the debts of the entity. What result then?
The commission actually faced a similar type of question in the Ceres decision, which found that based on the evidence in the record, that the Maryland Port Authority was a constituent unit of the state, yet they failed to meet their burden of showing that the Treasury would be put at risk. So even in that situation, the Commission found that the entity was still an arm of the state, even where the burden was not met on the Treasury factor.
And here, on the state control here, isn't the power to remove the power to control? I mean, that's kind of the basic theory of government.
It is, but I don't believe so when you look at the confines of the entire Enabling Act. Indeed, PRIPA is charged with complete control and supervision of all of its undertakings, including its expenditures. It is a separate entity.
But the governor could tell the people, do this or I'm removing you.
There's no authority under which they could tell the Board of Directors that.
Mm-hmm.
In the In re Auer case,
the Board of Directors in turn could tell the, I guess it's the executive director, the same thing, because isn't the executive director removable at will?
I believe so, by the Board of Directors, not by the governor.
So why wouldn't the scenario I just painted give the governor control?
In the In re Auer case, the Supreme Court held that where other indicia of control are lacking, and there's no risk to the state's treasury, that the fact that the governor appoints the Board of Directors
appoints, that's different. It's the power to remove that's the key.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the power to remove gives you the power to control, if it's at will.
Mm-hmm. Well, in order for the governor to do that, he would essentially be removing his cabinet level positions, and that would also require Senate, the approval of the legislature to replace those.
To replace, not to remove.
Correct. But I think, this has not been held to be
cast a shadow on removal. It gives the legislature, I take it your argument is, it gives the legislature leverage with respect to the next inevitable step.
Precisely.
Nonetheless, that leverage is in the hands of the legislature, which is part of the Commonwealth, right?
The Commonwealth, yes.
How does it help you any that the Commonwealth has leverage on what the Commonwealth does? How are you any stronger than if the government could replace without one?
I think where the question started was the power of the governor. Now we're talking about the
power of the governor as the actor of the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
So does it really matter that the replacement also involves other actors of the Commonwealth? Does that really make any difference?
I don't know. But the First Circuit has held that this is not a dispositive feature in looking at entities, the public corporations created by PRIPA, and indeed the Supreme Court in the In re Auer case.
Under element two of the Morris test, though, why isn't this powerful control on the part of the Commonwealth over the entity?
Well, the Enabling Act, that is one indicia of control. Certainly, however, the Enabling Act provides other indicia finding a lack of significant control. Certainly the fact that PRIPA has complete control and supervision over all of its undertakings, we submit, is a very strong indication that the Commonwealth did not intend for the governor to control PREPA.
When these four officers are doing their work on the authority, are they paid separately?
I don't believe so.
So it's part of their official duties as part of their official duties for the Commonwealth when they're acting?
They sit on the board based on their seat, on the other seats in government.
Part of their official duties?
Correct. But again, I submit this is, has
so
never been held to be a
kind
positive.
So it's not some kind of, honorary chair of a private entity kind of thing?
Correct. But again, several courts have reviewed this before and have never found that to be dispositive in light of other indicia of control.
On the Treasury point, what do you do with 2303? That seems to suggest that in some, put aside this case, that in some cases the Commonwealth will be subject to responsibility for actions of the authority.
In some other cases, that may be correct. However, it's certainly not correct here. I mean, these cases arise under PREPA's Enabling Act authorities and not the Dock and Harbor Act. And that provision specifically.
This is something that's puzzled me about the whole case. For the arm of the state branch of the argument, mm-hmm. as opposed to the question of whether the authority was acting as the agent of Puerto Rico with respect to the particular complaint, isn't it something that gets resolved with respect to at least an entity at any given moment in time, mm-hmm. one way or the other? Right? I mean, it's either an arm of the state or it's not an arm of the state, right?
Well, I think when you look at
it's not an arm of the state today with respect to one claim and not an arm of the state with respect to another claim, although it might be an agent of the state with respect to one but not the other.
I think that's true to an extent. I think when you're analyzing whether an entity is an arm of the state, you're also inherently looking at the authorities given rise to the complaint at issue. And
why?
Because that's where the authority for the entity to conduct.
Do you have any Supreme, I mean, I know the First Circuit on this, but do you have any Supreme Court case which makes the arm of the state determination depend upon the particular litigation in question?
I don't specifically, however, certainly, you know, the typical analysis will look at what functions
and
are
any,
at issue.
Any typical Supreme Court analysis?
For lack of a better word. We submit that these cases, in analyzing them, you need to look at the authorities under which PREPA was operating. And it does not, PREPA does conduct certain governmental activities, but those activities are not at play here. What's at play is PREPA's authorities to develop, improve, own, operate, and manage marine terminal facilities. It's a landlord port. It's a marine terminal operator subject to the Commission's jurisdiction. So we need to look, and that's a proprietary role. We submit that we need to consider PREPA's functions under those actions and activities.
Counsel, purely concededly state agencies can function in proprietary roles, can they not?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Purely state agencies that nobody would contend were not entitled to state status mm-hmm. can have proprietary roles, can they not?
Sure.
So how does that get you anywhere to say that in the activities under which these claims arise, the authority was conducting a proprietary operation?
Well, because it goes to the degree of control.
I thought you just conceded that you could have a pure state agency that could exercise a proprietary function. Now, if that is the case, then how does it help your case any to say that this was a proprietary function being performed here?
Because PREPA has not been structured to be a constituent unit of the Commonwealth government. It's structured to run independently.
I think you're kind of reasoning in the circle or begging the question. You're saying that it's not a state entity because it's not a state entity.
I don't really see
how it helps you any that they were doing a proprietary function here, and your answer to me had nothing to do with that argument.
I think what I'm trying to argue is that it's not a state entity because the way it was structured.
Okay, that's a different argument.
Yeah, and
really doesn't help you any that this particular claim arises under something being done as a proprietor, does it? I'm asking the same mm-hmm. questions Judge Williams did, but I didn't really get any help from the answers you gave me. Mm-hmm. So if I sound repetitive, I am being repetitive.
Mm-hmm. And I apologize. I think the key here is not proprietary function. I think it's indicative. It does illustrate the situation. However, I think the key that we're looking at is the structure of the entity. And we're doing that under either the
commission. Well, I thought your argument was that proprietary mattered under 2303. And that
to the correct
and therefore if you just look at the individual case going to Judge Williams' questions
yes. mm-hmm.
then under 2303 if it's proprietary you're not if I got this right you're proprietary you're not liable
it matters under 23 absolutely it matters under 2303B because there's a specific exclusion
right.
for when PRIPA is acting in its proprietary capacity, and that's what brings the actions at issue outside of the Dock and Harbor Act. It's a specific
question than whether the entity is, in the first instance, entitled to sovereign immunity. That may be a reason why sovereign immunity wouldn't apply in a particular case on a waiver theory or mm-hmm. some other theory.
We have to submit
a different question than whether it is, in the first instance, entitled. Is it not?
Yes, I think it goes to the point that the Dock and Harbor Act does not apply. We're not looking to that act.
Okay.
So I think that's it severs the connection and argument that these cases actually arise under 2303B. They do not. It's simply not an issue.
Let me ask you just one other thing as your time expires. As your time's already expired, I'm going to ask you, what do you say about the dignity theory out of South Carolina Harbor or whatever that was?
Mm-hmm. The circuit courts have looked at that, and specifically the Woods case from the Second Circuit, Roundout Valley, has held that federal circuits have dealt with the South Carolina case in two manners. Either they have held that it doesn't actually impact the test, or they have tried to incorporate that into their test.
How did the commission deal with it in this case?
By reviewing the dignity interest first, and that is the second way that Woods found that South Carolina has been considered. We first looked at dignity, and then we looked at Treasury. And that's consistent with some other circuits as well.
On these facts, what would we say if we were analyzing how the commission found that this complied with the dignity test? You're writing an opinion for us. No, you're doing it very quickly, much quicker than we'll do.
I think the dignity of the Commonwealth is not at issue because the complaints do not challenge the Commonwealth's programs or initiatives. They challenge.
That depends on how we classify
your
authority.
Yes, yes. I mean, our argument, however, is that it does not challenge the Commonwealth's initiatives or programs. It challenges PRIPA's activities in its own right, and this goes directly to the Trans-Caribbean case, which held that when PRIPA operates pursuant to its marine terminal operating authorities, it does so in its own name and not as an agent of the Commonwealth. And there's specific language in the Trans-Caribbean case that goes to that effect.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, we've taken you beyond your allotted time, so thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Is there time remaining for rebuttal? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm very bad to overlook interveners.
Thank you very much.
You may intervene.
Good morning, Your Honor. To answer a couple of questions, I think can be found in the Ports Enabling Statute, which says it has a legal existence separate and apart from those of the government and any officials thereof, and that its debts and property are those of PRIPA and not those of the Commonwealth.
Was that not true in Morris?
No, because in Morris, WMATA was designed to have an operating deficit, and Virginia and the district have, and Maryland and the federal government have to pick up some of those deficits. And
in
I believe
meantime,
that's
it has an independent existence.
WMATA?
Property belonged to the authority. Is that not true?
Not like the Port Authority. And WMATA, for example, to do their financial plans and their transit plans had to be approved by the states. The, you don't have anything like that here with the Port Authority. And also, a question was raised about the governor's power to remove. The First Circuit has held that removal, the power to remove is not control. And I think that's true here because...
Well, I understand that, but that's just standard government theory is the power to remove at will is
the
power to control.
Commonwealth does not have...
It's also factually accurate.
The Commonwealth does not have veto authority, and I think it's typical here that in order for the governor to get his way, he does have to remove them. He can't just give an order and say, do this.
Right. Well, that's how it always works. You give an order, and if the person doesn't follow the order, then you remove them.
Right. But you can't until you find somebody who will follow the order. But that shows, again, the independence of the board. The board could say to the governor, no, we're not going to do this.
And the governor says you're fired.
That's right. But the governor doesn't have the authority to say, you're going to do it because I told you to do it. He's going to have to fire them until he finds somebody finally willing to carry out the order.
That's how we got the term independent counsel. We got a prosecutor the government couldn't fire. That's probably before your time.
No, afraid not. I think also you asked about the Dock and Harbor Act statute 2303B, which carves out liability for the Commonwealth when the authority is acting in the exercise of its property rights. Well, this again goes to one of your tests, which is risk to the Treasury. And there is no risk to the Commonwealth Treasury here. The port is designed to be self-sufficient.
When you say here, you say in this case.
In this case, yes.
Right, but there's a broader risk to the Commonwealth Treasury from 2303B in other cases, even if we assume you're right about this case.
There is no risk in this case because the Commonwealth...
I said in other cases.
In other cases...
I don't know if this has arisen, this provision's ever been triggered. I just don't know.
Well, the...
But on its face, it would suggest that it could be.
No, Your Honor. The PRIPA's debts, funds, and properties are deemed to be those of the Port Authority and not those of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and that's in the enabling statute.
No, but the argument is that there are things the authority could do.
I'm sorry.
The argument is that there are things the authority could do that under local law would immediately produce liability for the Commonwealth.
Yeah, Ports and Harbors Act, or whatever it is, it imposes liability on the Commonwealth, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor, because it specifically carves out in contraposition as when acting in the exercise of the property rights of the authority as a public corporation.
So you're saying under no circumstances could the acts of the authority subject the Treasury of the Commonwealth to risk? Tell me under no circumstances could it subject the Treasury.
You could say yes or no with a tweak.
Yeah, that's
as
yes
one of
no.
Our counsel did, but
when acting in this proprietary capacity, no.
Well, that's
right,
yeah.
You put in the when acting in the proprietary capacity. Forget
that's
that
your tweak.
Certainly,
tell me,
Your Honor. Yes.
There are some. Whoa,
yes.
Wait a minute. Whoa,
yes,
wait
and I can give you an example for harbor. You know, the port is in charge.
So the answer is yes.
Of harbor.
With explanation.
But that's not this case. That's not.
That doesn't have to be this case. If it had been this case, I wouldn't have asked you a hypothetical, would
okay. Because
that's not this case.
Okay.
But Judge Kavanaugh's question is based on the assumption that the risk to the FISC is the part of the test in Morrison that's being applied here. Not the risk to the FISC in a given case, but is there exposure of the Treasury in the nature, in the structure of the entity? If it becomes an arm of the state because there's risk to the Treasury, then there might be some other question about whether the sovereign immunity is waived by something or whether it's protected by something.
Well,
but in the first instance, why does it matter that this is not one of those cases in which the Treasury is at risk in this determination?
Because the enabling statute has set it up to be self-sufficient, self-governing, and there is a specific carve-out that says, and one of your tests is risk, that says when they're acting in their proprietary capacity, the Commonwealth is not responsible for anything the port does. And in this case, we are challenging marine terminal leasing practices where the port acts like a landlord, and as the First Circuit says, it's akin to renting an office building, and there is no liability. If we recover at the FMC, we will have to look to the port to pay our reparations. We will not be looking to the Commonwealth. And that was one of the things that was established in the Trans-Caribbean case. Because there, again, the port was acting in its proprietary capacity. The solicitor went in and argued we're not responsible, and the court agreed. I see I've used my time. Have any other questions?
We use your time.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Westwood Robinson used to say those lights only control the bar. Only God can control this band.
That's a little tough sometimes.
Do we have any time, or do we have to give it, John? Okay, we'll round that up to two. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Judge Kavanaugh, to answer the specific question you asked me about payment of the salaries for the members of the board, they are not paid separately. Okay. They are just government officials who do that as part of their jobs. I'd like to make 4 points briefly in response to some of the arguments that have been made here. First of all, Judge Williams, I think you put your finger on a critical question here, and that is whether the arm of the state analysis can be conducted kind of on a function by function or a transaction by transaction basis, or whether it's kind of an all or nothing question, at least at the time. And the First Circuit is the only court that I have encountered that has ever suggested that you do it on a function by function basis. All of the Supreme Court decisions assume that it's a once-for-all determination, or at least within a period of time, and none of the other circuits of which we are aware have suggested that you can do it on a function-by-function basis. And when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense to do the latter. Think of the Morris case. You know, you'd have a situation in which somebody was claiming that WMATA is an arm of the state for purpose of the metro service, but not for the bus service. And then you could divide, you could divide up the various functions into sub-functions and litigate about those. So it would defeat the purpose of sovereign immunity to slice it up that way. Secondly, our opponent cited a few provisions of the Enabling Act that they suggest indicate less than complete control over the authority. The legally separate provision, though, has its analog in the WMATA Compact, Section 4. The fact that the authority here can borrow without its debts being the debts of the Commonwealth also has an analog in Sections 27 and 29 of the WMATA Compact. And the provision in Section 336D, which the FMC cited, which talks about control over undertakings. That word undertakings is defined in Section 332 of the Enabling Act as simply meaning property.
The FMC exists, presumably, at least in part, because there's certain limitations on states which have been created by the Constitution and under the Constitution protect interstate and foreign commerce.
Sure.
Now, suppose the FMC starts an action against the authority to enforce that. Now, that's not within the 11th Amendment restriction, right?
That's correct. That would be a suit by the sovereign.
Now, suppose it has a proceeding in which it considers that, and then a party such as the interveners here. Suppose the FMC concludes by shutting down the proceeding rather than shutting down the authority's activity. Would the ordinary rules on a private attorney general, so-called, I mean, it's fiction, of course, but a party whose interests were affected adversely by that decision, would it have standing in federal court to seek reversal of the FMC's decision?
As long as the FMC, rather than the state agency, is the adverse party, I think so.
Well, it would be the adverse party for a while, but if the plaintiff in that case won, there would be an action against the authority essentially brought about causally by the action of a private party.
Well, I think the answer to that is that once the federal sovereign is out of the picture, then sovereign immunity would then protect the state agency. I think that's
well, except
the answer.
In this case, a private party stirs the federal sovereign into action.
Right.
Even though the federal sovereign, at least as represented by the commission, wanted to sleep.
Right. Well, and I think that's the very issue that the Supreme Court dealt with in the South Carolina ports case,
right,
and held that falls equally within the banner
of
sovereignty.
Well, I'm not sure what the implication of that case is for this hypothetical case.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Give us a recess.
Stand, please.